Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be celebrating Mardi Gras with Kim Vaz, author of The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. And, because we just had the Muses Parade, we'll visit with Claudia Lynch, the creator of Shoe Stories. Kim Vaz is the Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Education at Xavier University of Louisiana. Her area of research is the use of expressive arts as a response to large group social trauma. She's here with us today to talk about her new book, The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. Kim, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Now, I think that so many New Orleanians have a notion about the baby dolls, these incredible women who dress up in short satin dresses and bonnets for Mardi Gras and St. Joseph's Night. But I wonder how many know what a long history this is.
I don't think people realize that it goes back to 1912. It was there at the beginning with the emergence of the Zulus. So it has a very long tradition. It started in a vice district around Perdido and Gravier Street that was created at the same time the ordinance to create Storyville took effect. The only thing is that Perdido Gravier Street area was held in abeyance. So it was never really a legal red light district, and it was created for African Americans, specifically the vice and pleasure of African American men who were not allowed to go into Storyville to have their pleasure. So these women worked in the dance halls, they worked in the brothels, but of course we have to remember it was a time when prostitution was legal. And everybody in New Orleans, the thing that I love about this city is its sense of community and belonging. And everybody can belong to a club no matter what profession they're in. You just have to have a profession and you can be in a club. And so the baby dolls, who were women who worked in prostitution, formed a group, and they were considered an uptown group in rivalry of black women who were working downtown in Storyville. There are cultural and racial castes in terms of skin color differences that fueled this kind of rivalry, and it was on top of the bigger rivalry between uptown and downtown. And one day, these baby dolls, or women who worked uptown, had heard that the downtown group of women were going to mask. And they said, well, we don't know how they're going to mask, but we know they're going to mask, and we want to do something really special. So they got together at 3 o'clock in the morning after they had finished working, and they said there would be no alcohol because they meant serious business. They had to plan their Mardi Gras masking. Few people outside of New Orleans don't really realize how serious masking is. It looks fun and like you just do it on a whim, but so much planning goes on for the whole year in terms of planning your costuming. So these women said, we're going to call ourselves baby dolls because, you know, that's what the men call us. They call us baby dolls. And we're going to be red hot. And to be red hot was to be associated with jazz and the new music of the times. You know, like hip hop is in bounce, it's young people's music. Well, jazz at that time was young people's music. And these were young women. And they came out in satin costumes, little short skirts, which was scandalous for the time.
Right.
And they
very short.
very short. And they appropriated male behavior, and they were smoking cigars and flinging money at men and just having a good time. And, you know, I say that I'm a researcher of large group social trauma because when legal remedies fail, as they did with the period that ushered in Jim Crow, what we were left with as a community was masking practices and creative arts. Mm-hmm. And so while these women weren't getting together to do that, they were getting together to make a statement about who they were and their self-importance and self-identity in comparison to another group of women that I write in the book were the only other human beings that would recognize them as human, because they were not quote unquote respectable women, and respectable classes didn't respect them. But in the space that play creates, these women could recognize each other and say, I am, I'm alive, I'm a baby doll.
And I thought it was hilarious that they were giving out money. I mean, you know, that every baby doll had to show up with so much money.
Absolutely. They were proud of their independence. They didn't get money, you know, they didn't borrow money from people mm-hmm. to mask. They earned it, you know, the hard way. And they had to show up that first time with at least $50. Right. And the one thing that they were competing was to find out who had the most money. And some women had money stashed at home because they weren't going to run out of money.
That's certainly, you know, more impressive than beads, you might think.
Absolutely. Oh. I bet anybody giving that out today would have a large following.
Now, one of the major sources for your work was the material gathered by the Works Progress Administration. I wonder if you talk a little bit about Robert McKinney, who posed that great question that's central to your book. Who is this baby doll and why is she referred to as such? You really told his story in this book, too.
It was so exciting to find Robert J. McKinney. Robert McKinney worked on the Louisiana Writers Project, which was directed by Lyle Saxon. McKinney was the only African American. There was a Negro unit headed by Marcus Christian, but McKinney never worked in that Negro unit, which was housed at Dillard. He went out with other whites who were field workers for the Louisiana Writers Project, collecting information that they were strictly guided to collect, and it had to do with people on the margins of New Orleans society. They collected all kind of folklore. Because he had grown up in New Orleans and he was so well known in the city, he graduated from McDonnell 35 High School, which was the only public high school for African Americans for a really long time. He graduated in 1933 from Xavier University. And he wrote for the Louisiana Weekly, and his articles were picked up by the Chicago Defender. He was a very good writer. All of the information, the African-American information in Gumbo Yaya, comes from the interviews that he did and the transcripts that were typed up after he did the interviews. Robert Talent took most of that work and put a different spin on it and told the story as if the material either was collected by Robert Talent or kind of dropped down from nowhere. You know, we didn't have all the safeguards, you know, that we practice today in research. So Robert McKinney was mentioned in Gumbo Yaya. But his work subsequently was used by many different white writers. He died in 49 or 48, and he was 39 years old. His work is so important. As I got to know more about Robert McKinney, I found that he has literally hundreds of transcripts on different aspects of New Orleans. He really had a respect for the women he interviewed. Even though their lives were not respectable lives, they had no shame in their game, as we could say mm-hmm. today, in terms of who they were. And he picked that up, and he talked about how proud they were of themselves, and also how, like, they were bosses of the neighborhood. So we know that these were really strong, tough women who, because they didn't have education, they didn't have respectability. They didn't have a male protector. They were constantly in trouble with the law for a variety of reasons. They were very vulnerable. But yet, they had a lot of pride in themselves and in their ability to costume, to sing, and to use their bodies to, you know, to say, I'm here. I'm important.
Now, you put the baby dolls in several traditions, partly the resistance to Jim Crow. You place them very strongly as women of jazz. And also, you talk about how the idea of the baby doll itself was a national sex symbol in the progressive era.
Absolutely. There were many, many songs that were being published at that time about baby dolls. Pretty Baby by New Orleans native Tony Jackson, of course, is and remains one of the most famous songs, you know, about love. At that time, terms like papa and mama and baby were being appropriated by popular culture to serve as endearing terms for one's lover or beloved. And so the baby doll was, you know, a kind of sex symbol. There was another song, when grown-up ladies act like babies, you gotta love them. you know, so this idea that grown-up women were imitating these young girls, you know, it really stirred the imagination of men at that time. And these women appropriated that image and turned it on its head.
So tell us about the more recent incarnations of the baby dolls, because the baby dolls are back.
They're back in a really big and revitalized way. Many people know about the late Antoinette Cato and her Ernie Cato baby dolls. People are so excited about what Antoinette Cato was able to achieve. She herself is a Mardi Gras icon. She started the Ernie Cato baby dolls to keep Ernie's name alive. She knew that they had masked with the Indians. When she was little, she remembered seeing them, and she thought, you know, I want to bring this practice back. So she was one of those women who began to revive and revitalize the tradition. To Eva, or Eva Perry, who is known as a local businesswoman, dates the founding of the Ernie Cato baby dolls in 2002. They wanted to change the body image of the baby dolls to say, we're professional women, we're working women, we're women who own businesses. And so they would give out pralines, or they would go and appear in order to bring business back to Antoinette's Lounge. So they were businesswomen, and they encouraged other businesswomen to mass with them. And the first time they came out, they had about 50 women with them.
Wow.
Miriam Baptiste Reed, whose mother had the Golden Slipper baby doll group, came to Antoinette's Lounge and taught them how to dress, how to walk, how to flirt, how to be a baby doll.
Ratty walking is ratty a big walking. Thing in this book, isn't it?
Absolutely. One of the things that one of the baby dolls said, do you know what walking ratty is? Well, we used to walk ratty and shake on down. So walking ratty is a kind of step that leads into a very athletic and sensual dance. And the women were very proud of their dancing.
And there's a whole school of dance now that's working on baby doll material, right?
Absolutely. The New Orleans Society of Dance, founded by Melissa White, has as their signature ensemble group, the Baby Doll Ladies. They're distinguished by their face paint, the beautiful porcelain faces that they wear when they mask. They have choreographed routines. They're developing chants. They have a real fun chant called Fire in Your Draws, which was written for them by Eddie Duke Edwards, a jazz historian and musician whose Aunt Vanilla was a baby doll back in maybe the 40s. And they do that really well. Melissa has termed what she's doing with her brother, DJ Hectic, who's their musical ambassador, as the resurrection.
Oh.
Bringing back what has been dormant in the culture and updating it and modernizing it. And Melissa was vital in the exhibit that's now at the Presbyter.
I know. That's a very special exhibit that people can see all year long at the Louisiana State Museum at the Presbyter. Well, since we're in the middle of carnival season, I wonder if you'd read that description you have about Mardi Gras masking in your book.
For maskers, Mardi Gras is more than a day. It's a workspace in which one prepares to participate in the concrete transgression of the everyday social order, to perform reversals, to participate in communal activity, to forge collective identities, and to assert one's personhood. Carnival identities are in existence all year long, but normally submerged in daily life.
Well, you've certainly brought them out, which is a great thing. Thank you so much, Kim. We've been talking with Kim Voss, author of The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. It's available at area bookstores. and the exhibit at the Louisiana State Museum runs through January 2014. Check out theycallmebabydoll.org for more information. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to clap my hands, going to snap my fingers, strutting like a peacock, feeling like a millionaire. I'm going to stamp my feet, gonna start to whistle, strutting like a peacock, feeling like a millionaire. Why, she said she loved me, what great surprise. You know I love her, you can tell it by my eyes. Gonna clap my hands, gonna snap my fingers, strutting like a peacock, feeling like a millionaire.
During carnival season, people take up certain crafts with a passion. As a member of the crew of Muses, I spend most of my Sundays painting and glittering and decorating shoes with friends. I love shoes, and I'm not alone in this. My next guest, Claudia Lynch, is known for her love of shoes, which she has rendered in prints and a book that is a wonderful collection of her illustrations called Shoe Stories. It's colorful and funny and sexy in the ways that all the best shoes and their stories can be. Welcome to The Reading Life, Claudia.
Thank you, Susan.
You've done so many things. You have such a resume. Theatrical designer, bridal milliner, tutu maker. You've even written a book about wedding veils. But you truly seem to have found your calling with shoe stories.
I think so. It's impossible to stop doing them because people just demand that I keep going.
How did you get started with the secret life of footwear?
Well, it was really completely by accident. I was a new member of the Northern Ohio Illustrator Society. We were living in Cleveland at the time. And I was getting ready for my first art show ever. I had never participated in an art show at all. And the theme of the show was games people play. And I thought, oh, everybody's going to do the Cleveland Browns or the Cavs or something, and I don't want to do that. So I just picked up some ideas to do some children's games like leapfrog and hopscotch. So I had these cute little illustrations going, and as I started to paint them, I thought, this is really stupid. These look like Mary Engelbreit drawings, and she does it very well. I don't have to do it again. What? I can't be doing this. So I put it down, and I just started to think. And as I was thinking, I was doodling, and I never doodle, ever. I'm not one of those people who sits on the phone with a pencil in their hand, ever. But I was doodling shoes for no reason. And I'm like, no shoes, games. Get with the program. And after a while of telling myself no more shoes, that it had to be games, I just, like, to spite myself, made a shoe with a dart as the heel.
I know that one.
And I looked at it and I went, that's kind of cool. And then I drew the croquet shoe that had a croquet ball for the heel and a wicket for the open toe and a mallet across the front for a strap and a checkerboard shoe that looked a little more like a shoe, a boot that had a checkerboard and a chess piece as the heel. And I thought, well, these are kind of interesting. All right, I'll do this. And I painted them and they turned out great. And I stuck them up to my wall with tape and I just about fell over when I saw how puny they seemed. And I just thought, oh my God, I cannot even deliver these. They just look small and puny. They were about life size of shoes, which are not that big when you get down to it. They're about 6 inches wide. And so I just hopped on my bicycle to just forget about everything. And as I was riding my bicycle, the stories just started coming to me out of whole cloth. In this Sam Spade kind of a voice with lots of puns and innuendo. And I didn't have anything to write on because I was on my bicycle. So I just kept reciting them over and over and perfecting them, I guess, changing them until I could remember them long enough to ride my bike home. And I got home and I ruined a few paintings at that point because I tried writing them on the paintings. That didn't work. My handwriting wasn't good. Printing didn't look good. And I thought, what would Sam Spade do?
Exactly.
He'd use a typewriter. So I went to my basement, brought up my dusty old typewriter, and put paintings right in a typewriter, which I had never seen anybody do, and typed them on the paintings and delivered them to the gallery.
Did you feel lucky to have a typewriter at that moment?
Yeah, I really did. I really did. Well, it was a while ago. It was 2001, I think. And so, you know, it wasn't as unusual as it would be now to have a typewriter. But yeah, even at that point, not everyone did.
And that wonderful typeface, American Typewriter.
Right.
It's my favorite typeface.
It's good. It's really good.
And so suitable. Now, a lot of these shoes are stilettos, which I personally cannot walk in. So I wonder if you'd explain your attraction to stilettos.
Well, I think the shape of a shoe is very graphic. It's like a pear or a coffee cup. I mean, something that explains itself right away, but you could do a lot of things to it. And which I do. Everything is very architecturally made to actually represent something else, like a can of tomatoes becomes a shoe, or the dart became a shoe, or there's a shoe that is actually Red Riding Hood. And as someone said, it doesn't look like Red Riding Hood's shoe. It looks like what Red Riding Hood would look like if Red Riding Hood were indeed a shoe.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the French Quarter shoe in this book, which is very different from the others.
Is this the man's shoe you're talking about?
Or no, the woman's shoe.
French flat?
Yes.
She had a sexy little flat in the French Quarter?
Yes.
That's the only one where I knew ahead of time what it was going to say, because the writing always comes last.
It's such a lacy, lovely little thing.
Oh,
You know, it's just different.
It's meant to look like, of course, wrought iron railings on a balcony with little hearts in them. So it's very feminine and sweet, even though it's not a stiletto. It's still pretty sexy.
Now, why did Sam Spade's voice, why did that noir feeling appeal to you? Is that something you like to read, or
it is
something you enjoy in films, maybe?
It is something I like to read. A good trash, you know, whodunit is always wonderful. And those are some of my favorite authors, but I don't really think that's where that came from. I really can't explain it, or why the narrator, the voice that I use, is a man. I can't explain that either.
I know. I think that's fascinating. It just gets you. It sucks you right in, though.
It really does. The picture puts you in the mood right away for the story.
I wonder if you'd read one of your shoe stories for us. But tell us what the shoe looks like.
Okay. This shoe is the can of tomatoes that I mentioned, and the heel, the stiletto, if you will, is made out of two large, ripe, luscious tomatoes, and the stem of one comes up right through the heel, which cracks me up. I always like when I make part of a shoe that can't actually be physically worn. I don't know, that just cracked me up. And the front platform of the shoe is an old-fashioned looking, kind of retro can of tomatoes with the word pomodoro written on a banner across the front, which is Italian for tomatoes, and then a little thong on the top with a few more tomatoes for decoration. And the text says, I won't have the Sam Spade voice going, though. I'm sorry about that. Picture this as Alec Baldwin or Chris Noth, if you will. And if you're listening, please call me. Those stems of hers went all the way up and kept right on going. As you can imagine, that wasn't either of the first two things I'd noticed about her. I'd only been in this country for a couple of days, but already I could see why pinching tomatoes was the national pastime. Why not, I thought, when in Roma.
I love that.
Well, this one also has one of my favorite things to incorporate, which is an intentional typo. And I love when I can do that, because people love to discover them. And at first, they'll draw to my attention as if I've made a mistake, and then they'll notice that the story doesn't even work without it. And the intentional typo here is in the tomatoes. And my sister actually thought of this when I told her what I was working on. And there's a space between tomato and toes.
Of course. And you have a lovely painting of a salsa shoe right next to that
one. Oh, thank you, Susan. Yes, this salsa shoe was part of the same little series for the Tomato Festival that I did in Nashville a couple of years ago. And this one is actually meant to represent a green tomato, but it looks a lot more like a shoe than most of my other ones do, and less like a tomato. You really have to get that idea from the position of it next to the other tomato shoes, although it does have a brooch on the top of the strappy sandal that is meant to represent a tomato stem. But it's just green and kind of a strappy sandal with some jewelry on it and a stiletto, of course, kind of a Cuban heel, like a ballroom dance shoe. And the text says, While in Cuba, I took a few salsa lessons to pass the lonely afternoons. For a teacher, she was pretty green, but then so was I. The sultry swaying of our hips gradually chipped away at my inhibitions, and by the end of the hour, I actually felt it might appear to the casual observer that I had both a left and a right foot.
Very sexy stories, Claudia.
Thank you, Susan.
Claudia Lynch's shoe stories can be found in bookstores around town. And for more of her work, check out ClaudiaLynch.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan. This has been really fun.
What do you want for Christmas?
Shoes.
Valentine's Day?
Shoes.
Birthday?
Shoes.
What do you want for breakfast?
Shoes.
Shoe free!
Books inspire so many things. Great movies, beautiful paintings, and yes, wonderful music. So here's a listen to a song inspired by literature. Fish remembers one of Narnia's royalty in the song Prince Caspian from the album Billy Breeze.
Oh, to be Prince Caspian, float upon the waves. Oh, to be Prince Caspian.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses In the Garden of Beast, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin by Eric Larson. Tuesday, February 5th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. The 1718 Society, a student-run literary organization of Tulane, Loyola, and UNO students, continues its reading series Tuesday, February 5th at 7 p.m. at the Collins Hotel on St. Charles Avenue. February's featured reader is Josip Novakovic, author of the short story collection Infidelities. Liz Williams discusses In Science New Orleans, a food biography, Wednesday, February 6th at 7 p.m. at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Looking for a writer's group? Barnes & Noble West Bank hosts one every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. And let us hear from you. We'd love to know about your reading life. You can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.